Hi, everyone. Welcome to Stoppage Time on a Wednesday as we look back at the first league win of the year for Atlanta United at New England and look ahead to finally a home match. It's been a month since Atlanta United has played at home, but we'll have one on Saturday against FC Dallas. Mike Conti, Jason Longshore, Jimmy Vance, and Stoppage Time, as always, is presented by Aaron's, where you'll find the perfect choice for your budget. With top style in brands and name brands and furniture and electronics and appliances, get started at Aarons.com or visit one of 47 stores across the Atlanta area. This will be the I told you so version of Stoppage. But we've been trying to tell people that it'll come. I mean, the chances are being created. The last couple weeks playing with four in the back, they've done a very good job, generating chances, getting shots, maybe not so much on frame. And it really finally came together in Foxborough on Saturday. Season high on shots, season high in shots and target, season high in chances created, season high for shots inside the box. I mean, these are all really good numbers. You got two goals. You probably could have had a few more. But Hugh Douglas asked me on Monday, what would be your biggest criticism of the way that Atlanta United played on Saturday? And I can't really think of anything that stood out to me.
Wasted some chances. I mean, that's where you're at.
But isn't that soccer?
Yeah, I mean, you got to create them first, and that's always the first priority. You left some on the table. Didn't hurt you this time. There's matches where it can. This time, New England, look, you play the opponent in front of you, you know, and we've played DC United, who's going to sit generally against Atlanta. They've done that historically. They did it again. Even in their home opener, they sat a little bit. They got a goal off a set piece. That changes the game. Come back here against Cincinnati. You score early. They decide to sit. They don't want it to get out of hand. They grow into the game. You don't put them away, and they get a point. Philadelphia, they sit. They're going to sit. They sit. They make life difficult. You can't break them down. You get a point out of it. This one, New England didn't sit at all. They're not going to sit. That's not how they play. They don't have that in their DNA, and when they opened up, you hurt them. You punished them for it.
Yeah. Don't forget, you can type in your questions on the bottom of your screen. We'll get to them throughout the show. Do you feel like people feel better now? Like, do you feel like everyone's relaxed now? It's a completely different tone around how the season has started for this club, or do you feel like it's not there yet, that people still want to see more?
I think there's relief that, you know, we got the win, and they can stop talking about Frank DeBoer's hasn't won a league game in so many years. But having this positive momentum coming into the back-to-back home matches, it was huge for the club. And now we can really have the chance. If you reel off three wins in a row, then it's a whole different conversation. You're near the top of the league.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You've got two matches in hand on a lot of teams at the top of the table right now. Not all of them, but you'll play an FC Dallas team on Saturday that's played seven league matches and has won four. I think Dallas, one of the more under-the-radar teams right now in the Western Conference. We'll get into that a little bit later. Let's dig a little bit more deeply, though, into what happened Saturday in New England. Let's start with Barco with the two goals, two very kind of different goals. One was a little bit more of a team goal where Tito Villalba really, really had a huge role in setting that up. The second goal, Villalba got an assist, but it was just Barco with a world-class bending golazo, whatever you want to call it. And Barco was not even in the starting 11, but it was the concussion to Eric Rometty that allowed for him to come on and play about 80 minutes. And it was very fortunate that he was able to get on there and make an impact.
Yeah, and you got to give credit, I think, to Frank DeBoer, Darlington Nagbe, and Barco and all of this, because the roles changed as this match went on. You started Rometty and Larenowitz because you knew how New England was going to approach the match. You know they're going to play direct. You need some extra bodies in there to win the second ball. You're set up to do that. 15 seconds in, Eric Rometty gets crashed into from behind, still shocked that there was not a yellow card there. And he's injured, and he can't continue after 10 minutes. And as you mentioned on Dukes and Bell, as Darren Eels mentioned, that there was an independent doctor who allowed him to go back in. There's been questions about that. There are some protocols in place from Major League Soccer. They're not widely publicized. I hope this is kind of one of those things that pushes them to be a little more public about how this stuff is handled, because we don't know exactly. It would help. Anyway, that happens. You have to make a quick adjustment on the fly. We talked about it while they were checking Eric Rometty. Frank DeBoer brings Darlington Nagbe over to the bench area. They're talking because Nagby's role goes from being a creator, a 10, to a guy who's going to have to fight for the second ball. That's a very different mindset. He did a great job of it. Barco comes in, not knowing he's going to play at that point. He has to snap in very quickly to play an opponent that is going to harass him at all opportunities. And he did. He immediately started creating chances. And he comes in and makes things happen straight away. Yeah, maybe there's a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. Maybe he wanted to start. I think he obviously did. Everybody does. He didn't get that opportunity. He came in and made the most of the opportunity that presented itself. That's what you have to do as a professional. He did great.
I think there's been a lot of reading into the fact that he wasn't in the starting 11. And I don't really know if there's a whole lot to read into. I think situationally from match to match, you're approaching things very differently from a tactical standpoint.
You should be.
And maybe there was something that Frank DeBoer scouted or a member of his technical staff scouted that made them think that, okay, we would be better off with Rometty, Larenowitz, and Nagbe in the midfield.
100%. I mean, it's not even about, like, something Barco about his game. It's you had to play a second holding midfielder. They haven't done that this season. So you're bringing Jeff into the team. You have to pull somebody. Mm-hmm. You're not going to pull Joseph. So it's Gressel, Villalba, Nagbe, or Barco. One has to sit to bring in the holding midfielder.
Now,
which one are you going to sit?
Now, was I a tad bit surprised that it was Villalba over Barco? Yes,
mm-hmm.
I was surprised by that.
I was too. But then, okay, then let's follow that out. Barco comes in for Villalba. Does Barco play on the wing or does Nagbe play on the wing?
Right.
Where would you rather have that work out? And if you're looking at Barco as a central player, and I am, I don't know if Frank DeBoer exclusively sees him as a central player. I think he's best in the middle. Then it narrows that decision down
right.
to Nagbe or Barco. And against an opponent that is going to put you under pressure, you'd like to have Nagbe, who's a little more of a two-way player,
right?
At least to start.
And we don't really see Nagbe as a winger necessarily.
He can,
but it's not ideal.
Not in this type of game. In a game where you're going to have a lot of possession and you're going to dominate possession in the other team's half, yes.
Yeah.
This one, not so much.
It was an interesting team sheet when we got it on Saturday because I think we had a couple questions about, all right, we know Mikey Ambrose is out. We're not 100% sure where Escobar is right now. We know that Bello is out. So we weren't really surprised to see Breck Shea in there as a left fullback. Parkhurst as a right fullback makes a lot of sense now, knowing what we know about Escobar and how he could probably give them 30 minutes at most. But when we saw Parkey at right fullback, I'm like, okay, that's different. That's a change. But I actually thought quietly Parkhurst had a really, really good match in that role.
Well, he did. Both of the outside backs did. And again, it's the way New England's going to approach it. Can you play Parkhurst and get that same quality against every opponent? Maybe not at right back because opponents are going to do things differently. New England makes things pretty simple. It's just a physical battle. And you need to have both the physicality but also the intelligence and positioning. Parkhurst knew when he could step up and affect the game going forward. He also knew that, look, for the most part, I'm sitting back and I'm not going to let Christian Pena get in behind me because he's got me for speed. Pena really didn't affect the game very much.
No. And you had Miles Robinson, solid as ever, as he's been throughout the season. LGP, solid as ever. Guzan gets a clean sheet. Very happy to see that. Joseph, a little bit unlucky, it felt like. I don't necessarily feel like he played poorly. It was just very unlucky.
You create four chances. You didn't play poorly.
Right.
And he did. And, you know, look, Joseph's going to do different things this year. He said it to our friend Felipe Cardenas of The Athletic. You know, defenders are playing him differently. He has to adjust. It's going to create opportunities for others, whether it's Joseph creating it or it's him vacating that space and taking defenders with him.
Mm-hmm.
Opponents know what he does now. They know what Atlanta wanted to do last year. They know how effective he was. They're going to try to take that away. So you have to come up with a plan B. Otherwise, it's going to be trying to feed balls into Joseph in the 18 with two defenders bracketing him, and it's low percentage.
All right, let's go to the whiteboard, and let's talk a little bit about some of the things that Atlanta United did to kind of address what New England was giving them, which was a little bit unusual in and of itself. Revolution...
To a degree, yeah.
Different.
Yeah.
As we predicted going into it, they were a little bit weird, and it played out oddly for them.
Yeah, so Atlanta is in red, New England's in black here, and New England's defending this goal. So you look at it, and you're like, why is New England playing 2-4-4? because that's kind of what they did.
Felt like it.
It was your two center backs, and it was Luis Caicedo on the right wing, who is generally played as a winger or a central midfielder, playing very high. It was Brandon Bye on the left side, who played forward in college. He's a converted outside back. His natural tendency is to go. And the reason they could do that is every time New England received the ball here, it's get your head up, boom, every single time. You look at the numbers for New England, and Brandon Bye, Jahlil Anibaba, Andrew Farrell, Antonio De La Maya, Michael Mancian, whoever the defenders are, they lead the league in long passes. They're not playing here, try to get this guy going down the wing, try to combine here. Nope, it's no combination. It's bomb it forward. So what does that mean Atlanta has to do? And this is where you get to that scouting. You look at that and you say, all right, we're going to play four in the back. We're going to play an extra holding midfielder here. All right, if they're going to play with Pena up high and Fagundes and a bunch of different guys, they kept running in different wingers at you. When they play up very high, your outside backs, Parkhurst, Breck Shea, they have to stay home. Because if Breck Shea gets adventurous and goes down here and makes a run, all right, if you're Andrew Farrell and your natural tendency is to play long, so you bomb it down here into this corner, now you've got Leandro Gonzalez-Pires stretched. Then you've got Miles Robinson recovering. Then you've got Parkhurst recovering. You've got him here on the ball, and you've got 3v2. It's not what you want. So you're going to sit at home. You're going to sit. You're going to win the ball. Breck Shea led the team in recovering possession. Not really his game. Not really what we brought him here for. He did the job that he needed to do in this one. Now, the other side of playing two holding midfielders is this. You're playing direct down the middle. You've got Juan Fernando Caicedo up battling. You're going to have 50-50 balls between Robinson, Caicedo, LGP. It's a battle here. You're not going to win possession in those long balls. You're going to win it after the first touch. And if Atlanta's winning their aerial duels, which they did a pretty good job of in this one, it's going to be Larenowitz, it's going to be Rometty to start in here, winning the ball, and then looking at, all right, now we've got these guys going. We've got them up here. Now we've got a chance to play. Now we can get forward fast. New England kept getting exposed. That was the biggest thing, is when you break a team like this and you get that first goal, when you're committing numbers forward, you're trying to play direct, you're trying to bomb numbers forward, these guys cut inside, you're chasing everything. All right, you've conceded a goal. Atlanta wins possession. They hit a through ball. Where's your effort going to be then? You break a team's spirit. And the way Atlanta did that was how dangerous they were on the break. What, 19 shots?
Yes.
19 shots. How many on target? Six?
13.
13 on target?
I think so. Almost positive.
I'll check. A lot. Let's just put it that way.
Hold on. I will check.
Okay. We'll get that in a second. So you created a ton of shots because New England, and this is something Brad Friedel's talked about, they get to a point in matches where they run out of gas, and when you're losing and you're losing these individual battles, you don't want to chase back. You don't want to make that 50-60-yard sprint after you made a 50-60-yard sprint to try to get involved in this play. When you play that way, if you're not getting goals to show for it, it'll break you.
Yeah. Eight shots on target.
Eight shots on target. Okay.
You had more shots on target than New England had shots total in the game.
Brad Kazan, one save. Because they weren't creating anything here. When they did, okay, it's 1v1. Breck Shea won 1v1 battles. Michael Parkhurst won 1v1 battles. Robinson, LGP, won their 1v1 battles and then started attacks quickly. Atlanta didn't waste time in possession in their own half. They didn't need to because New England was exposed.
New England's going to struggle this year, I think, although they do have some players. Andrew Farrell single-handedly recovered maybe two or three times to snuff out goal-scoring opportunities.
Farrell was outstanding. It's one of the best performances in a loss that I've seen in the last couple of years.
Really, really good. Cropper made some nice saves. I mean, they've got some players. Bunbury is now out of favor because he's not scoring. Don't get it. I mean, you're keeping a very dangerous player on your bench if you're Brad Friedel by doing that. But I think a lot of people have challenged okay, yeah, it's a 2-0 win, that's great, but you did it against New England. And I think what you and I try to impart to our audience every week is any team in MLS on any given night can beat anyone, even Colorado, on any given night. The margin from your top team to the 24th best team in this league is actually pretty narrow.
It's not La Liga. It's not the Premier League.
No.
There's not this huge gulf in class. There's a difference in class. Atlanta United had better individual players than New England on the field, and they had a better plan to deal with what New England was going to do. There's this thing about, you know, should you adjust to what the opponent's going to do, or should you make them play your game? Look, in this one, New England's approach, it's nothing about, like, making them do something different. This is just what they're going to do. You know, you can't make them be patient and try to play possession. They're not going to. There's no way to make them do that. So you know that coming in, you're foolish if you play one here and you play two attacking and this guy's here and he gets overrun. You're foolish to set up your team that way. You're foolish to set up with your outside backs going all day because you're going to get overrun. You have to play the opponent that's in front of you. Mm-hmm. And Atlanta came into that match knowing exactly what New England was going to do. They dealt with it effectively, and they knew exactly how to exploit it. And they did that. Could have scored a couple more goals. That's okay. You got two, and that's all that matters.
Yeah. The way that Atlanta United is defending right now, by the way, two goals is going to get you a result. It's going to get you a draw or a win in most cases. You had the late meltdown at Monterey, which I think
different,
might have been more
fatigue induced
than anything else. Herediano was weird in Costa Rica because it was your first game. But I think what we found is if you score two or more goals, you're going to get a result if you're Atlanta United, because that's how well they are defending right now. Okay, we're going to get to your questions now, brought to you by Country Financial. Don't get overwhelmed. Get started at TakeSimpleSteps.com. Really appreciate all of you tweeting us questions during the week. They've been phenomenal. We're going to take your Facebook Live questions as well, but let's dig in a little bit to some of what has been tweeted at us this week, because there's a lot of good questions.
Let's see. On Twitter, we've got a couple questions that are kind of similar, but let's go with, I think, Cactus. He says, are we going to stay in the 4-3-3 formation since Escobar is back?
Probably, but there might be matches where you adjust based off the opponent. That's the biggest thing that I just talked about with Andy and Randy on the Midday Show is, look, this team is going to do different things. Last year, you pretty much played in the same way for strings. Like, you played 4-2-3-1 exclusively in 17. You went back and forth between 3-5-2 and 4-2-3-1 in 18. You're going to adjust now. You're going to see sometimes two holding midfielders. You're going to see one. You're going to see four in the back. You're going to see three center backs. It's flexible. I think they look best with four in the back. I think it's worked the best. But there's going to be opponents where that might be risky to do. And right. You might want an extra center back in.
Tito Villalba, by the way, says they played a 4-4-1-1 on Saturday, which I only bring up because I think we get so bogged down in what's the shape, what's the formation, and in reality, it really doesn't matter. I mean, it's four in the back. It's four in the back. We know that.
The difference between 4-4-1-1 and 4-3-3 is your wingers playing deeper.
Right.
That's it.
Let's see. On Facebook, John Asen asks, in the parallel universe where Rometty didn't have to come off so early and Barco remained on the bench, how do you see the New England game and Frank DeBoer's tactics playing out?
I think it still would have been a 2-0 win.
Roughly. It might have been 1-0. Maybe you don't have a moment of brilliance like Barco had, but you win the game. I don't think there's any way you don't.
The reason why I say that is if you look at the two really solid chances they created before Rometty had to come off, and I think one of them might have been when you were playing 10-on-10, like right after the injury. There was a chance in the first or second minute. It was there. It was just coming in a slightly different manner. I think this was one of the first matches where I think we could say Joseph was consistently getting service. Consistently. Yeah. For 90 minutes.
And he was consistently involved, even beyond just the service. He was involved in touches back in this part of the field, too.
Right.
See, on Facebook, Chris asks, hey guys, looking at the back line and how Parkey played at right back, what do you think this means for Saturday against FC Dallas? Well,
this is kind of tough, isn't it? Because you're going to have an odd man out situation unless you want to move Parkey to left back. First of all, let's assume Escobar in a world where he is playing.
Right.
I don't think we can make that assumption for this week.
I don't think you can either.
Okay. But let's say for Colorado, maybe you can.
Okay.
All right. If Escobar's your right back, you're not doing anything with LGP and Robinson, I think then your question is, it's three guys for one spot. Bello, we don't know about his health. Shea and Parkhurst at left back. Do you see it the same way?
Yeah, but it's two different opponents, too. I mean, Dallas is going to do things completely differently than Colorado, so that's going to play into your lineup choices as well. I think this week, you know, we have to wait and see what Frank DeBoer says after training tomorrow. Is Escobar ready to give you a start? We don't know yet. Is Bello? The hope was that he'd be available this week. Don't know yet. So you're going to play a team in Dallas who wants a lot of the ball. They want to build up out of the back. You would probably like to get some numbers forward to press them, cause some mistakes there. The other approach would be to sit deeper and absorb pressure and hit them on the counter. We haven't really seen Atlanta do that this season. Doesn't mean they can't. We just haven't seen it yet. There hasn't been an opponent like this. So how do they handle it? It's a good question right now because we haven't seen a team come in and want to play the way that Dallas does. I don't think they're ready to change who they are yet. I don't think they go away from building up out of the back. So if they're going to do that, how do you counteract it?
Yeah. Dallas is an interesting opponent. We're going to get into it a little later on. If you look at them statistically, one thing they've done a phenomenal job of is getting a lot of set pieces. Mm-hmm. And that is something that Atlanta United will have to contend with on Saturday, and that could even maybe factor into the lineup decisions a little bit.
See on Twitter, Shiva asks, who would you prefer to see as a super sub, Tito, Barco, or Pitti?
It'd be Tito out of those three. As a super sub for an extended period of time now, right now it could be Pitti to ease him back in, right. But you're not going to use Pitti Martinez or Ezequiel Barco over the long haul as a super sub.
Right.
I think also we need to start getting into the mindset of starting May 5th, you're going to have a lot of matches and not a lot of time. So it's kind of like we've talked about before. I think you might be looking at a rotation where it's Pitti, Barco, and Tito, three guys for two spots, and you kind of rotate it because
you'll see more of that.
You're playing a ton of midweek matches. Mm-hmm. I mean, you go from Kansas City to Toronto at home, then Orlando at home, then on a Wednesday to Vancouver, then all the way across the country to New York, then back across the country to RSL, going Sunday to Friday. You're going to have rotation.
Yeah.
And I did think it was encouraging that Pitti got in.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was extremely encouraging. He drew three fouls in 2 minutes.
Looked sharp.
Looked really, really sharp. Very small sample size. Kind of as an aside to this, I feel like what we're seeing now with Barco, a year plus into being with Atlanta United right now, reminds us that maybe we need to be a little bit more patient with Pitti Martinez. Mm-hmm. When I say we, I mean many of you watching us. Because Barco last year came in at the very end of training camp, then got hurt. Then played great, then got hurt again. Then other things happened. He had a very, very choppy, disjointed season last year. Well, Pitti didn't have an off season. Had a phenomenal training camp by all accounts. I mean, the match we saw against Cholos, he was amazing. Then he gets hurt on international duty. He misses time. He is a young guy adjusting to a new country, a new culture where he doesn't have his family with him. Takes time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes we forget that he might be the South American Player of the Year. Barco had a tremendous final season with Independiente, not South American Player of the Year, but very, very good. It's a lot of pressure that comes with it. It takes time to adjust.
That price tag brings a lot of pressure.
Yep.
And it does, change things. I mean, Barco and Pitti are two guys who are used to pressure, but it's different when it's pressure in an unfamiliar situation, an unfamiliar environment. So, look, the other thing, too, that I think people often leave out is, yes, he's South American Player of the Year. He's a great player. MLS isn't a pushover league either.
Nope.
And that South American Player of the Year award puts a bullseye on your back.
Mm-hmm.
People want to show you, hey, you're not going to come here and dominate. That's showing up so far. He's going to rise above that because he's too good of a player not to.
It's funny, when Barco scored that golazo, we had one of those obnoxious mass fans sitting right below our booth who was screaming 28-3 at us the whole first half. I went back and listened.
I'm glad I missed that.
Boy, that really cuts to our core, by the way, being the MLS Cup champions, that really hurts quite a bit to hear 28-3 jokes.
How many years has Atlanta United existed?
Two.
And how many years has the Revolution existed?
Way more than two.
And how many cups do they have?
Zero.
Yeah.
They've been to the final cup.
Bunch of times.
They brought out the Vince Lombardi trophy before the match, too. But anyhow, the reason why I'm bringing up this guy is when Barco scored that screamer, he immediately goes, well, that's why you pay him $14 million. Like, yep, that is exactly why. Now, we've been seeing the quality for a while. I think now it's really on display for even the doubters. Any other questions?
Oh, yeah. Hear a statement from the garlic bread warlord.
Okay, Nick.
It's always dangerous.
See you on Monday, by the way, Nick. Looking forward to that.
He said, Frank got it all right. The players looked far more comfortable against New England. Is New England bad? Yes, but this isn't the AP poll. You win the games in front of you.
Yeah, and one other point to that, I think for as much critique as Frank got rightly in Monterey for not subbing, Frank, the last couple weeks, has really nailed it on his subs. Mm-hmm. And I thought, here again on Saturday. Now, you could say Barco. He almost didn't have a choice. That was the obvious one. But I loved when Tajan, I think I'm mispronouncing his first name, but Buchanan, right. He goes in, he immediately creates a chance, and Frank immediately brings Escobar in and puts him at left back to kind of silence that. And really snuff that out. Mm-hmm. And Buchanan was never dangerous the rest of the match. And then bringing Pitti on as a change of pace at the very end for Barco. For the second league match in a row, I thought he made his subs very wisely in Columbus, and he did again Saturday night.
Look, if we're going to look wistfully back at the Tata Martino days with Atlanta United, go also back and remember how everybody would get bent out of shape about substitutions with Tata.
Yeah.
And he didn't make substitutions, and nothing ever changed. And, rabble, rabble, rabble. Well, now you've got a manager who is making some changes, and he's changing the way they play and match more than we've generally seen, but that doesn't get talked about.
Right.
I thought the Escobar substitution was dead on perfect because you had to make that there because the game was starting to flip a little bit. You needed one there to keep it at that scoreless, and you did. It was a perfect sub.
Well, we want to welcome you back into Stoppage Time. If you're just joining us now here at the bottom of the hour, it's presented by Aaron's, where you'll find the perfect choice for your budget and style with top name brands in furniture, electronics, and appliances. Get started at Aaron's.com. We're one of 47 Aaron's locations across the Atlanta area. We're going to look ahead to the Dallas match in a moment. Let's take a step back, though. Just kind of look at the landscape of the league now, because I think the sample size is big enough where we can start making judgments on teams. Many of them have played seven matches. Mm-hmm. A few of them, like Atlanta United, have played five. Do we agree LAFC right now, best team?
Seattle's right there with them.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd put Seattle right there with them. Both have a little bit of question mark to me, just that Seattle, can they hold up? They do have some older players, the back line especially. That was my concern coming in. It's been great so far. Mm-hmm. Let's see. LAFC defensively as well, a team that puts them under pressure. Let's see. Well, we're going to learn a lot because those two play each other in back-to-back weeks.
It is kind of interesting, isn't it, how this time last year the East was so far ahead of the West. You had Atlanta United, New York City, New York Red Bulls, just playing lights out for the first month or so of the season. Columbus had a really, really sharp start. It's kind of flipped a little bit this year where you have LAFC, Galaxy, those two LA teams easily dispatched of East teams that are above the playoff line right now.
Don't sleep on Houston.
Absolutely. I mean, if they stay healthy, absolutely. Dallas is an example of a team that might be a little bit below the radar right now. They have 13 points.
Right.
But they're only fifth in their conference because so many teams are playing. And basically what's happening is the West teams are getting a little bit fat against Eastern Conference opponents. LAFC beating DC United might be an example of that. SKC crashed out of Champions League. That was a very, very tough ask.
Yeah.
Coming back home, down 5-0.
They fought for it.
Give Peter Vermes credit. I mean, they went for it, and when you go for it against Monterey, you're going to lose 5-2.
You can.
That's what they did.
Yeah, you absolutely can. They went for it. I mean, full credit to Peter Vermes. He threw everything he had at it. Probably should have managed the game down there a little differently just to keep it tighter, but, you know, he said it himself. Look, his roster, Atlanta United went more toe-to-toe with Monterey than Sporting Kansas City could hope to. Because you're talking about different levels and quality. And Atlanta wasn't at full strength, but they put up a better fight. Sporting Kansas City in that second leg, you've got nothing to lose. You see what you can get in the first half. You couldn't get enough, and you gave up two on the break. You're done.
Okay, SKC was involved in the biggest controversy of the weekend. And wasn't a result of SKC's team. It was Kaku of New York Red Bulls. And if you have not seen it, very kind of odd, almost weird, disturbing incident where Kaku, I think out of, I don't even want to guess what his intent was, but I am pretty sure that he was trying to kick the ball at the ad boards on the touchline, and he missed, and he drove the ball at very close range into the stands and hit a spectator in the face. Mm-hmm. As of right now, at 2:32 on Wednesday afternoon, as we're doing Stoppage Time Live, we have not heard from the league about any discipline beyond the one match he'll get for his red card.
Right, but one thing about the way the discipline goes down, we were talking about this before we started, teams know what's going on. Like, I would assume at this point the Red Bulls have been informed, Kaku has been informed as to what the decision is. They get a chance to appeal before it goes public.
Right.
That's a little different than other sports, right, where the sanction is announced, then there's an appeal.
And we saw this, if you remember, last year with Harris Madunian of Philadelphia Union getting some extra games for that incident he had with the referee here in Atlanta.
But it wasn't announced until, like, right before they played their next game.
Because they had hearings.
Right.
I mean, they had hearings where Jim Curtin and Alejandro Bedoya and a whole bunch of people testified. Mm-hmm. And so you are correct. Yeah. That a decision may have been meted out, but we don't know what it is.
Yeah, we don't know where things stand.
What should it be?
Well, from my bit of research, the longest suspension in MLS history is 10 games. Okay. I don't know if there's been one longer than that. That was Brian Mullen for a tackle on Steve Zakuani that broke his leg. It was a horrendous tackle. Before that, it was 9 games. Ricardo Clark for kicking Carlos Ruiz in the back. One of the most legendary moments in league history. If you haven't seen that one, go look it up. I don't think you're at that level, because if that's your precedent for serious, dangerous foul play involving potentially injuring an opponent, this is completely different than that. This is a whole different category. I don't think you've ever had anything like this in MLS history.
Not to this
severity. Not like this.
Yeah.
6 games was my gut reaction, because it has to be very significant. Because whether he was trying to kick the signboard, just kicking the ball out of frustration, not even thinking about where it's going.
Doesn't matter, does it?
He put a fan at risk.
Yeah.
And you don't know what can happen there, because if you hit somebody in the face, friends could jump out onto the field, you could create all kinds of problems.
Or you could, I don't know, seriously hurt the guy.
That too.
And it's a miracle that he was not seriously hurt, at least to our knowledge.
There's so many different things that can spin off.
We're talking about, I mean, it could have gone horribly wrong. I mean, imagine, you know, if an Atlanta player did that in the Orlando end, like at their fan, fans can go, you know, crazy. I mean, imagine if that was like a dad and Kaku drilled the ball and it hit like your son or your daughter in the face. Stuff, it can go horribly wrong in those situations. They need to drop the hammer.
There's so many things that can open up out of it. That's why I agree. You have to drop the hammer on it, because that can't be acceptable. That has to be something that any player who was in that situation thinks about going forward. They can't think that it's okay to be frustrated and just kick the ball wherever, at into the stands, near a stands, whatever, or do anything that could put fans at risk. So I feel like 6 is the right kind of number. If 9-10 is your record, 6 feels about right.
I also think there's a chance that Kaku might get dropped.
Well, that's
he's had a very, very turbulent year already with Red Bulls.
They're not going to take a loss, though. They're not going to drop him and take a loss on, however, I think they paid $8-9 million for him. I think in a perfect world, they sell him this summer. And if they sell him at a loss, that's different than, like, dropping him altogether. They're not going to buy out his contract like Giovanni Dos Santos or anything like that. I think the way this should play out is it's a 6-game suspension from the league. The team might add a game or two on their own. And then they try to move him in the summer. And get what they can and move on. It's not helping the team. It's not helping anybody right now. He's not playing well. It's a distraction.
And this is really the last thing Red Bulls need. Yep. Right? I mean, they, as much as Atlanta United and Portland and New York City have struggled to start this season, Red Bulls might be the biggest mess of all.
Well, you saw the rumors today, right?
No, I haven't. No.
Sky Sports is talking about Thierry Henry being linked to the New York Red Bulls.
Oh, I did see that. I didn't really believe that to be credible.
I don't know.
But, well, man.
I don't know. There was a report last night, NBC Sports, NBC Pro Soccer Talk, mentioned that Henry has been talking to Red Bull Global about a job within the Red Bull umbrella. We played in New York. I get connecting dots and seeing, okay, does this go here? The thing that makes no sense about him becoming the manager right now is he's never managed in the Red Bull system with this style of play. When he was at New York, they didn't play this way. So you're going to come in and change everything midstream about your identity. Red Bull soccer clubs don't do that.
No.
Salzburg, Leipzig, New York, Brazil, they all play in a similar way. Henry's not ready to do that yet.
Right.
If he comes in as an assistant somewhere, makes a lot of sense. Probably needs it after the bad time.
Or a technical director somewhere.
I think he needs more seasoning. He wants to be a manager. I don't think he wants to be a technical director. Mm-hmm. Monaco went really poorly for him. Mm-hmm. He was a good assistant with Belgium at the last World Cup. That everybody talked about his work there. Bring him in as an assistant, whether it's Salzburg, whether it's New York, whether it's Leipzig, and move on from there. As much as Chris Armas needs to be questioned about where things are, going in that direction would make no sense. If you're going to move on from Armas, you bring in John Wolanek from New York Red Bulls, too.
Yeah. If Kaku gets 6 matches, by the way, that would be within the window where Atlanta United's going to see them on May 19th, just for the record. They might be better off without him, for all we know right now. I mean, they are a mess. By the way, thank you to Minnesota and New York City for playing the most entertaining match of the week. A 3-3 slugfest that we were watching in the booth in Foxborough had us very entertained. Sean Johnson, what a shame. One of the worst howlers in MLS history, but accidents happen. Still not 100% sure what he was trying to do. But Atlanta United, it's like we said, they have an opportunity right now. I think the three-match stretch that we talked about last week, New England, Dallas, Colorado, this is the most challenging of the three matches in that stretch. And this is going to be the determinant, in my opinion, if Atlanta United is going to get 7 or 9 points out of this, or God forbid, 6. Because I think we're feeling very confident about Colorado. We're going to take your questions in a moment, but just on the surface with FC Dallas, let's dig in a little bit, because this is a team that Atlanta United had dead and buried in the 85th minute last year on the road on the 4th of July, and then Tesho Ekindele happened, and he's not with Dallas anymore, he's with Orlando, but you had some real flubs on the back line, and what could have been a 2-0 win became a 3-2 loss. Atlanta United recovered beautifully, and Dallas was never quite the same after that match. But it's like you said on the full-time report Saturday, they've kind of turned the keys over to the kids a little bit. I mean, this is a very, very young, different-looking team now under Lucha Gonzalez.
That game means nothing in the context of this one. They don't play the same way. Oscar Pereja was far more pragmatic than Lucha Gonzalez. Lucha Gonzalez comes in with a mandate, play the kids. Play the young players and play this style. Well, this is the style that he's played throughout the academy with them. So he's got the leash right now to go out and play this style and not worry too much about results. He's getting results, so he's in a really good spot. And he's got a ton of young talent that he is very familiar with. Paxton Pomacall, Jesus Ferreira, so many young players coming through that he coached as kids. So they know what he wants. He knows what they can do. You've got a lot of confidence. And if you haven't watched some of the behind-the-scenes stuff that FC Dallas has put out, watch it. It gives you a real sense of what they're all about.
Ferreira scored an open play Saturday when they beat Portland 2-1. Reto Ziegler from the penalty spot. Ziegler scored on a direct free kick last year against Atlanta United. What stands out to me, I mean, I mentioned that Ziegler got a PK. Dallas is top 5 in the league in penalties earned and converted. They're 2-for-2. They're first in the league in drawn fouls, and they are 5th in the league in corners, and they're 5th in the league in goals.
You have a lot of the ball.
So they're getting a lot of set pieces.
But you have a lot of the ball, so that's what should create that.
Although they only had 52% against Portland.
Yeah, I mean, but then Atlanta didn't dominate possession against New England either.
They didn't have to.
But it's not that. That's not why they didn't dominate possession. It's they didn't dominate possession because of the way New England approached it. The game was choppy.
Right.
Portland-Dallas, kind of the same way.
Yeah.
Dallas still wants to build out of the back. They still want to build up attacks from the back. Atlanta has to make that decision. Do you want to step up high and press, Or do you want to drop into a deeper block? If it's a mid block, if it's a low block, whatever. You have to make a decision and stick with it, because I don't see Dallas deviating from that. Even though they didn't have as much possession as Portland, they want possession. That's how they're going to play. Sometimes games, you know, take you different roads, but they want to play. You have to figure out how to deal with that.
They have quality. Barrios, Pomacall.
Barrios is one of the fastest players in the league. Pomacall is playing very well right now, one of the best passers in the league. They're very fluid. They interchange positions really, really well. And you have a guy like Ryan Hollingshead who can play anywhere on the field, and he's comfortable anywhere on the field. That just gives you a ton of flexibility. They can also rotate their guys, you know, and they've played a lot of different guys this season. This is a very good team that right now is feeling really good about themselves.
They've also had a little bit of bad luck with injuries, but they've been able to play through it. Like I said, results in 5 of their first 7 league matches. They're 4-2-1. Let's get back to your questions now, brought to you by Country Financial. Don't get overwhelmed. Get started at TakeSimpleSteps.com. Really want to thank you for sending us a lot of questions our way this afternoon on Facebook Live. We appreciate it.
Let's see. On Facebook, John Roper said, asked you guys, starting 11 predictions for Dallas.
It's almost impossible right now because of Escobar.
I assume he's not going to start.
See, I don't know.
I don't know, but we're speculating. I speculate that Escobar is not going to start, and I speculate that Remedy is not going to start.
Yeah, I would probably feel safe about that one. So if that's the case,
I think it's the same back line then. I think it'd be Shane.
The question would be Bello, because you'd love to have Bello in a game like this. This is a good one calling out for him. If he's ready, we don't know.
Well, and being 30 minutes ready and 90 minutes ready are two completely different.
But this is the thing. We don't know. We're making assumptions on a million different things, so... It's one or the other on the left side. You'd love to have Bello if he's ready. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think it's probably Parkhurst on the right, if that's the case. It's Jeff as a holding midfielder. I don't think you're going to play two holding mids, so I think it's Jeff, it's Nagby, it's Barco. It depends on Pitti's 90-minute fitness, if he can go on the left. But then you're back to the conundrum. Is it Pitti, is it Tito, is it Julian with Martinez up top? Which two?
I don't think you can take Julian off right now.
I would lean that way, too. But then Tito just had a great night.
Exactly. Yeah, 2 assists.
So, I mean...
Well, I guess it's a good problem to have.
Yeah, these are the things you're going to fall into. Right. So, that's what I keep saying. Like, this is not going to be a standard 11 every match.
Right.
It's just not.
Let's see. Nick Alifi, a.k.a. Garlic Bread Warlord, says, my question is sponsored by Country Financial. Can we talk about how Barco is now dropping quite deep, almost how Almiron would? His play has been exceptional. Oh my God, patience works.
Different role, too. I mean, you know, when you're playing centrally, it's easier to drop deeper than when you're playing out on the wing. So, you know, he's doing some of the things that Miguel Almiron did. Tito Villalba did some of the things that Miguel Almiron did in the last match. Tito led the team in tackles.
Mm-hmm.
Not something we've normally seen from him. So it's kind of just the way things play out sometimes.
Playing with confidence, too, which is something that maybe he lacked a little bit last year. I don't want to assume that, but I think Barco had very lofty expectations for himself last year, and because of all the things we talked about, he was not able to meet it. Now he is meeting those expectations, so playing with a little bit of swagger helps, too. It really looked like he was having fun. Didn't it to you? Like you just the body language was very positive. Obviously, after the second goal, you'd expect that. But it looked like it was very good body language, that he was just really enjoying the opportunity to play in that role and convert.
Well, just like we talked about with Dallas, the young guys feeling good about themselves right now. You're going to come in and play very free. Barco comes in, and things come off for him very quickly. He's feeling good. He's gonna feel very free and play that way.
Very confident right now.
Yeah.
This is an interesting question from Bart on Twitter. It says, after the opening of the beautiful Minnesota Stadium, I have to know, hypothetically speaking, where would you put a soccer-specific stadium in Atlanta?
Happening. Hmm? Well, you're putting it in...
Hypothetically, what location rather than downtown?
You're putting it downtown. Like, you're not building a soccer-specific stadium, putting it in the suburbs. That hasn't worked. Doesn't work in Frisco. Doesn't work for Chicago right now, and they're trying to move away from it. It doesn't work in that scenario. Doesn't work for Denver.
Yeah. The Herndon Stadium site would be what I would say, down by Mercedes-Benz. Now, I want to clarify that, I mean, like Jason said, we're not going to have a soccer-specific stadium built in this city It's just not going to happen. Even if there's NWSL, even if there's more of a commitment to USL, and not saying they aren't committed to it, but if you want to do something downtown with USL, I don't see this happening. If one day, God forbid, Mercedes-Benz Stadium no longer works as a soccer venue, I think that Herndon Stadium site, which is near Mercedes-Benz Stadium, which is a block behind the Vine City MARTA station, it's where they had field hockey during the 1996 Olympics. It's fallen into disrepair because it's just not used anymore. That, to me, you're close to mass transit. You got a lot of parking around there. You're in a neighborhood that's really kind of up and coming, walkable. I would love to see something in that Grady Stadium footprint across from Piedmont Park, but I think the concern you have there is parking.
There's nowhere.
You just don't have any parking.
You're stuck. It's just, it's not going to happen. And I know people, there's a small subset of people who would love to see a soccer-specific stadium.
I don't understand why, though.
I don't either.
Because, first of all, forget the gaudy attendance numbers. The atmosphere works at the Benz. And I have found, and I think you guys would probably agree, the atmosphere at the Benz is better for the 40,000 games than the 70,000 games.
It's different.
But I think it's more intimate. I think it's a little more, I don't want to say engaged, but the energy is just a little bit higher. For whatever reason, those curtains seem to really help with noise.
There's much impact in there. It's a good...
Yeah, visual. And I think everyone's paying attention.
Yeah, playoffs were different because of
playoffs.
Yes,
it's playoffs, though.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Playoffs.
I agree with Mike with the 45,000 games.
And look, the MLS Cup final was one of the best Atlanta sports atmospheres I've ever seen in any sport in this town. You can't do that. You can't replicate that in a 25,000-seat soccer-specific stadium.
You can't replicate that for a fourth home game of the year in April.
And to Bart's question, Minnesota made a mistake. They made their stadium too small. They tried to make it bigger before they opened it. They made it too small. That's another danger you run into when we have this conversation.
Look, here's the thing to me. If you're going to keep putting MLS in 19,000-seat stadiums, MLS is going to be treated like it plays in 19,000-seat stadiums, flat out. Atlanta United is treated differently in Atlanta because they play at Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Great Even point. In the 45,000 configuration, they're treated differently because of what they draw and how big it is. That's a huge impact here, and you start looking at why other teams are treated different ways in their own market.
Chicago.
Right. Let me redirect Bart's question for a moment, though. Let's say, and there's been chatter this week about NWSL, and I don't think Arthur Blank's touching NWSL until that league gets a little more stable. He's already been burned on arena football.
Let's hold that thought for 1 second because of the way the quote was framed. So it's Amanda Duffy talking to our friend Mitch Northam, who writes for Pro Soccer USA. And Amanda Duffy, the way she mentioned it, she said, basically, like, there were no problems with the capabilities of a potential ownership group in Atlanta. There's only one potential ownership group that she's talking about.
Right.
We know that. Yes. So I think they've had conversations. You could fairly guess from that quote. Now, I think she also mentioned that it has to be the right time. And that is even more important than anything else for me, because you have launched this club in 2017 on the field. You've launched a second team. You've launched an academy full-blown. You're doing a regional development school right now that is boys and girls. That's pre-academy stuff. So would your next step potentially be a girls' academy? Yeah, I could see that. That could potentially get you closer to being ready for an NWSL club. Now, also, they just bought that land near the training facility. If you're going to do it, you don't have anywhere to do it right now from a training perspective, from an office space perspective, from a locker room perspective.
Right.
So you have to do that too. Timing's not there right now.
No.
Could it be pretty soon? Yeah, it could be. And the NWSL is in a very interesting situation with the dissolution of the partnership with Lifetime A&E Networks. That came at a bad time. It was unexpected, according to the president, Amanda Duffy. So they're kind of figuring things out on the fly. You're moving all of the league operations, media-wise, social media, communications, all back to Chicago because U.S. Soccer manages that side of it. So this year is a year of flux. You got to get a TV deal, which is something they're working on. You got to get through the World Cup, which is a very complicated thing in the women's game. It's far more difficult on the women's side than the men's side. You got to deal with whatever tours you have after a World Cup, and you need to get this season done. But you also need to talk to Mia Hamm in Los Angeles because they want to do a team. They tried to do a partnership with Barcelona. It wasn't the right time. That happens. You fix Sky Blue and, hey, City Football Group, buy them and move them into New York and build a stadium.
Right.
Do that. And then it's a good time where Arthur Blank could come in and do it. The reason I think this is different than arena football, Arthur Blank could come in and take what Merritt Paulson's done in Portland, what Dello Hansen's done in Utah, what is happening with Houston and Orlando on a smaller scale, what's happening with Steve Malik in North Carolina, teams that are part of an overall club. But he could come in and take it to a whole nother level for the women's game in this country. And that could be, we know that Arthur likes legacy. He likes to leave a legacy. That would be an amazing legacy for women's soccer in this country. And he could do that. Arena football is arena football. It's not. He's not going to make arena football a big thing.
You're not going to get kids to play arena football growing up. No. I get that.
But he could get young girls playing soccer and dreaming of being a professional in Atlanta and in the region.
All right, so now let's circle back to Bart's question. Mm-hmm. Let's say we do have NWSL. Mm-hmm. At that point, would you favor a smaller scale soccer-specific stadium, maybe 15,000 seats, for your USL program and your NWSL program?
Nope, because I think what you do, the USL thing is separate. I'm going to put that to the side. I think at the beginning, you pair them up in Kennesaw.
Okay.
And I think your idea, because again, you want to be big, you want to be in a big spot. Your idea is to get them playing games at Mercedes-Benz. Mm-hmm. Building a separate place for them to say that they're not big enough to play in the real stadium, I don't think that's the right way to do it.
All right. One more NWSL theme credit. We've really turned left from Bart's
question. That's good. That's good. Sorry, Bart. I think.
What can we do to maybe get MLS and NWSL to maybe work together a little bit more closely where, let's say, Atlanta one day does have an NWSL franchise, and Atlanta United is playing Orlando City on the night of June the 1st. Why couldn't you have, leading into that, a match between the Atlanta women's team and the Orlando
women's team? How epic would that be?
As either the lead into it or the post-match.
How epic would that be?
Absolutely. But see, I think this is an opportunity that maybe, and I don't know if NWSL is resistant to it, if MLS is resistant to it, but if there is any kind of cohesion there, I think you could have some enormously successful doubleheaders. Not just here in Atlanta, in Salt Lake.
D.C. does it.
D.C. does it, but in Orlando, I think you could have a lot of success with that. Is that maybe one of the options?
Why it hasn't happened is the NWSL is not marketed by Soccer United Marketing. Fix that.
Right.
Do that. Get that done. Let's move forward. Two, MLS hadn't been in a position probably until recently that they had enough owners who were strong enough to do this. Mm-hmm. They do now.
Right.
So that problem solved.
Well, and you mentioned if Man City goes in and gets a piece of Sky Blue and combines it with New York City, there again, you have another.
It's going to help them get a stadium, too, by
100%.
The way. 100%. Get Soccer United Marketing on board so you get the branding together. I think that's one thing that's a little complicated. Like, it can't be the Portland Timbers women. It has to be the Portland Thorns. They're Nike. Timbers are Adidas. You have issues there. Get everybody in the same platform. Get everything working together, and not every owner has to do it. Don't make it a mandate, but Arthur Blank could do it.
Mm-hmm.
Cincinnati could do it.
Mm-hmm.
Open it up to USL owners as well. I think Louisville wants to do it. They're moving into an 11,000-seat stadium. Perfect. Let's go for it. There's plenty of ownership groups that would benefit from this because I think the difference in soccer, maybe than basketball, and that's the only other one that we really have seen this, is one, they're going to play the same season.
Right.
So they're going to play at the same time. And I think having a women's club attached and part of the men's club is going to enhance the men's club. It's not going to take away. It's not going to detract.
It's not going to
be a drain.
No.
It's going to enhance it.
No.
And it's only going to take both higher.
Yeah.
That's what's worked in England right now. Manchester United launched a women's team recently. Manchester City's investing heavily on the women's side. You have the International Champions Cup coming to Cary, North Carolina, with Lyon, with Manchester City, with Atletico Madrid coming to town.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool to see clubs invest that way. Would love to see it here eventually.
Yeah.
I think it will happen eventually.
Yeah.
And probably, what, 5-10 years? I could see it for sure.
Well, and within 5 or 10 years, we could have a Women's World Cup here in the United States, which would only help to raise the profile even more. I think your first step is perhaps the most important. You got to get that girls' academy started here.
And it here,
sounds
yeah.
Like, it sounds like it does not need that much more time for that to come.
You've
to
got infrastructure. And I think, you know, you kind of take what Amanda Duffy said, the president of NWSL, and you start to project it forward. Yeah, timing's a big deal. You know, you got to have all the pieces in place.
Yeah. The other thing, too, I mean, this is minor in the grand scheme of things, but if you do have an Atlanta NWSL team one day that's playing at the Benz, it really would enhance the Benz's chances to host the Women's World Cup final the next time. It's in the United States. And
how
we
cool
are
would
to believe,
that be?
Absolutely. And we are to believe that should be pretty soon.
2027 is going to be up for bid. And
it's
how
not
cool
that
would
far
it be
away.
2026 to have the Men's World Cup, have
right.
a World Cup semifinal here.
Yeah.
2027 to have the Women's World Cup final here.
And then the Olympics as well, the LA Olympics in 2028, where, again, and I don't know if they've announced the soccer venues for that yet, but it is typical to be spread out across the host nation. When LA had the Olympics in 84, they played games at Army in West Point, New York. When Chicago was bidding on the summer games, Minnesota was going to host. Legion Field,
RFK, and the Orange Bowl, I think. Or
Citrus
Bowl.
Didn't the Citrus Bowl have it, I want to say?
They might have had it. It might have been the Citrus Bowl instead of the Orange Bowl.
So, I mean, there again, long way down the road. I mean, boy, we got really turned left on Bart's question, but hopefully you guys, hopefully you all enjoyed it. I love the way Jason thinks. He's always thinking biggest possible scenario because, quite frankly, it will not become big unless you treat it like a big thing. I think that's been Atlanta United's mantra from day one, and that's why they are the big thing they are right now. Sure. All right, well, now let's return to the men's game, huh? Atlanta United FC Dallas, 3:30 for Five Stripes Countdown on Saturday. 4 o'clock will be the kickoff. We'll be on 92.9. The game, any just quick along the lines of a prediction, do you feel good about this?
It's going to be a fun one. I think we'll really get to see where Atlanta United is here.
Agreed.
I think there's just so many questions lineup-wise. We'll have a better sense of it tomorrow after Frank speaks to the media.
Feel confident, and I think 3-1. Joseph Hattrick to celebrate his dog, getting his dog back.
Oh, yeah. Oh, good man. Job, 17s, by the way. Yeah. Hey, oh, what a sweet doggy, too. Hey, now I hope that Skate Nofziger, she found a stray dog yesterday, too. I don't know if you saw
that. I didn't see that.
Oh, sweet look. My wife and I might end up adopting him. If, no one claims him. It's a sweet-looking dog. So hopefully we'll go 2-for-2 on dog returns, and then we'll go 2 weeks in a row on victories for Atlanta United. We'll be back next Wednesday for more Stoppage Time presented by Aaron's, where you'll find the perfect choice for your budget and style with top-name brands in furniture, electronics, and appliances. Get started at Aaron's.com or visit one of 47 Aaron's stores across the Atlanta area. For Jason and Jimmy, I'm Mike. See you next week.